this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, 40 Under 40, Plastic Surgeons Do It Right? Greta Hanley says she wants to redefine stereotypes in the plastic surgery field. Read about other winners in the special section inside. And that special section is 40 under 40. We'll read a couple of these. And first we'll start with Greta Hanley of Davis and Pyle Plastic Surgery. Title, Practice Development Manager, age 38. Company description, Plastic Surgery Center, birthplace, Washington, D.C. Family members, sons, Ty and Van. Education, bachelor's degree, University of Maryland. What accomplishments are you most proud of? Working in the plastic surgery field in the UK from 2005 to 2008, I hope to never lose the perspective of living as an expat and having a child in another country. What is your professional goal 5 years from now? Make the Davis and Pyle leadership team thought leaders in the aesthetic field in North America. Create a role focused solely on collaboration with other similar-minded local businesses. Continue to challenge and redefine stereotypes in the plastic surgery field. What community cause or charity have you been involved in during the past year? Raised and donated $5,000 for the Ronald McDonald House of Durham. Sponsored Fashion Spark, part of SparkCon. Sponsored Artsplosure. $2,000 donation for to Junior League of Raleigh. $500 to Models for Charity. A $400 donation and sponsored 4 children. Scott Hannon Memorial Foundation. Christmas for Kids. Also raised $1,200 for Pink Ribbon Fund. And sponsored 4 breast cancer survivor makeovers. What is the greatest obstacle you have overcome in your career? Learning to find some semblance of work-life balance. Finish the sentence, what the triangle really needs is to fight HB2. Nothing makes me madder than people asking for directions who own a smartphone. Who is your mentor? Dr. Jeremy Pyle. Whether personally or professionally, he leads by example and exhibits unending patience, vulnerability, and passion for his craft, team, and family. Who would make the guest list for your dream business lunch? Gary Vaynerchuk, and not just because he was a wine entrepreneur. Innovative and passionate, I first heard him on a business podcast and was hooked. I would love to hear his thoughts on the future of social media and marketing. And I like his foul mouth. What is your secret talent? Drawing, cartoons mainly. I so wanted to be a caricaturist at King's Dominion in high school. And we'll read one more in the 40 under 40 category, or the winners for this year. Another one is Brandon Baker of the First Tee of the Triangle. Title, President and Executive Director, age 30. Company description, Youth Development Organization. Birthplace, Columbia, Maryland. Family members, wife, Megan, and 2-year-old Cocker Spaniel Rescue, Lincoln. Education, bachelor's degree in recreation, parks, and sports management, and master's degree in sports leadership from Virginia Commonwealth University. What accomplishments are you most proud of? The 2 accomplishments I am most proud of are being one of 8 out of 174 chapters in the First Tee Network to receive the ACE level designation from our national office. Secondly, our organization being selected to receive the inaugural Volunteer Engagement Award in 2013. Both of these accomplishments speak to the effort of all of our stakeholders put into our mission and to the impact we are able to have in our community because of that effort. What is your professional goal 5 years from now? Continue to impact kids in our community through the First Tee of the Triangle by developing a golf course-based learning center to support our character education programs. This safe haven would allow for year-round program delivery, better diversification of program offerings, and provide an ongoing opportunity to build lasting relationships with kids who need positive mentorship the most. What community cause or charity have you been involved in during the past year? the first tee of the triangle. This year we will have well over 1,200 young people in our programs at local golf facilities having fun and gaining exposure to our curriculum. What is the greatest obstacle you have overcome in your career? As someone who grew up living in and out of shelters, cars, and generally in an unsafe environment, the biggest obstacle I have had to overcome is learning how to adapt, exist, and thrive in a much more affluent environment than I ever had exposure to growing up. Finish the sentence. What the triangle really needs is a municipal golf course. Nothing makes me madder than 3 putting. What is your favorite triangle restaurant? Little Dipper. Who would make the guest list for your dream business lunch? Lunch and an afternoon round of golf with Jim Goodnight, Jim Goodman, and Bob Ingram would be a dream come true for me. These individuals have all played such a significant part in making the Triangle the best place in the country to live, and I would relish the opportunity to soak up their knowledge and insights for both mine and the first tee of the Triangle's benefit. And we'll read more of those at the end if time allows, but now we turn to Biz. A quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by digital producer Mark DeRoberts. The first headline, his passion to connect communities. Raleigh bar and restaurant owner John Sealbinder must be busy nowadays with the upcoming opening of Little City Brewing and Provisions Company next month. The brewery, taproom, and a prepared foods market that originally was conceived some 3 years ago will come on board in tranches. First to arrive will be the brewery. The food market is scheduled to come in the October-November time frame. Everybody has been screaming for a grocery store downtown, Sealbinder tells Biz. We won't have toilet paper and light bulbs, but we will have gourmet food, not to mention at the same time we will be brewing our own beer. Sealbinder is dropping about $1 million into the project, located at the corner of North and Harrington Streets in Raleigh. Sealbinder's local icon hospitality also owns the Architect Bar, Greenlight, Inside Architect on Hargett Street, Level Up, Linus and Peppers, and Virgil's original Taqueria Taco Bar, all in one building on Salisbury Street in downtown Raleigh. There's some 500 to 600 homes within a quarter mile of us, Sealbinder says. Communities tend to form around breweries and tap rooms, so I'm trying to build a community by bringing in a German brewmaster, a well-renowned executive chef from the Hermitage in Nashville, focused primarily on quality. What's on tap for after the Little City project for Sealbinder? A major renovation of the Architect, which has been open now for 5 years. Local contractors, suppliers lend hand to build 4 Habitat homes. Hats off to the more than 70 Triangle area suppliers and contractors who donated their time, money, and materials toward the construction of 4 new homes over the course of 5 days for Habitat Wake's Big Builder Blitz event earlier this month. While the Builder Blitz has grown to become a nationwide event for Habitat for Humanity, local builders know that the program got its start in Raleigh, a project spearheaded by Raleigh builder Tom Gibson in 2002. This year was also the first year that 2 Triangle companies upped their support to become national sponsors of the program. Ply Gem of Cary donated siding and windows materials, and Martin Marietta Materials of Raleigh donated foundation materials to help build nearly 300 new homes across the country, including the 4 new homes on Skinner Drive in Raleigh. Participating Triangle builders included Dan Ryan Builders, Savvy Homes, Homes by Dickerson, Roebuck Homes, Saucy Burbank, and Sundance Signature Homes. HBO Silicon Valley writer headed here. Like Silicon Valley? Writer and co-producer for the HBO show, Dan Lyons, is coming to Raleigh. Lyons has been named a headliner of the upcoming CED Tech Venture Conference, which starts September 13. Lyons, who also wrote Disrupted: My Misadventure in the Startup Bubble, previously served as technology editor of Newsweek, as a technology columnist at Forbes, and as editor-in-chief of news site ReadWrite. Other speakers include Dan Ariely, a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University, Jerry Cuomo, vice president of blockchain technologies at IBM, Joe DeSimone, co-founder of Carbon 3D, and Caroline Fairchild, new economy editor at LinkedIn. Additional speakers will be announced in the coming days. Christensen nears cookbook launch. One of the Triangle's most decorated chefs, Ashley Christensen, is getting closer to the launch of her debut cookbook, a project that she says she was just starting to work on when Triangle Business Journal interviewed and featured her as its Business Person of the Year in 2014. The book called Pools, Recipes and Stories from a Modern Diner is available for pre-order through Amazon. The hardcover book, published by 10 Speed Press, hits bookstores September 20. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to On Real Estate by Amanda Hoyle. And on this page, the first headline, Who's Winning the Grocery Wars? The latest market share survey data from Chain Store Guide shows that Walmart and Food Lion are still battling it out for the number one position for market share in the Triangle, but the new numbers also show there are some new competitors gaining on their lead. Costco Wholesale, with the addition of a new store in Apex in March, increased its market share in the Raleigh-Cary metro area by more than 2 percentage points in 2016. Much of that gain, the numbers show, has been at the expense of Walmart and its subsidiaries, whose market share dropped in the 2016 report. Walmart is working on a plan to turn those numbers around, says company spokesman Philip Keane. North Carolina is a strong, important market for the company, and will continue to invest in jobs and store growth moving forward in the Triangle and beyond, he stated in an email. We recently made shopping with us even easier with the launch of our online grocery pickup service in 5 Raleigh area stores, and have more exciting announcements to make very soon about enhancing the store experience for Triangle shoppers. Highwoods executive gets Olympic nod. Highwoods Properties Senior Vice President of Strategy and Administration, Kevin Penn, is leaving the company to join the U.S. Olympic Committee in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Penn will be filling a newly created position as Chief of Business Operations and will report to USOC CEO Scott Blackman. Penn, who has been at Highwoods for 18 years and will also finish his 2-year term as chairman of the Triangle District Council of the Urban Land Institute at the end of June, will begin his new job July 18. The 2016 Summer Olympics in Rio de Janeiro begins August 5th. Developer plans single-family project. One of the Triangle's fastest-growing new home communities, Briar Chapel in Chapel Hill, is finalizing details to turn its latest phase of development into an enclave of active adults ages 55 and older only. The new age-restricted neighborhood, to be called Encore at Briar Chapel, will have about 140 single-family home lots on the westernmost side of Briar Chapel off of Boone Street. It will be built exclusively by Texas-based David Weekly Homes, which is already building traditional single-family homes in 5 other neighborhoods at Briar Chapel and elsewhere in the Triangle. Lori Ford, Senior Vice President in charge of Newland Communities, North Carolina, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. metro area communities, the developer of Briar Chapel, says the plan to open an age-restricted community within Briar Chapel has been in the works since 2012. That was after a commission study showed that the Triangle was so underserved by active adult lifestyle options that the company could convert all of the remaining undeveloped Briar Chapel land into an age-restricted community. New plan for Gritty Gateway Plaza Center. A Raleigh real estate partnership has acquired the aging Gateway Plaza retail strip center at Capitol and Crabtree Boulevards, about a mile south of the I-440 Beltline. The 6.8-acre property, which is surrounded by the Greyhound bus station and the former Raleigh Flea Market property, has the potential to become a new destination for retail and restaurant tenants that want to be close to downtown Raleigh but can't afford downtown's higher rents. Russ Jones and Henry Ward, partners at Raleigh-based Loden Properties, bought the 77,600-square-foot building in late May from the estate of auto dealer Bobby Murray in a deal valued at $3.45 million. Henry and I have been traveling a lot looking at what other markets are doing, and specifically in Nashville, they are seeing neighborhoods start to regenerate in older spaces. This seemed like the right place to try it, Jones says. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Pharmaceuticals page written by Jason DeBruin. The main headline, Duo Efforts Project for Rural Care. Two MD-MBA students put their heads together to launch a program that could revolutionize rural health care. We call ourselves a Teach for America for Healthcare, says Ann Steptoe, a dual MD-MBA student from Brown University's Alpert School of Medicine and Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. The program they created is MedServe and is being hailed as a first-of-a-kind program that will connect recent college graduates with rural health providers in desperate need of help. There is a common refrain in healthcare that the United States faces a physician shortage. That's not exactly true. It would be far more accurate to say that the U.S. faces a physician distribution problem, specifically that there are too few physicians in underserved and rural areas. Just 12% of medical students nationwide are choosing to enter primary care. During her first year of medical school in 2011, Steptoe proposed a research project that would connect students with rural health providers. I was promptly told that it was awfully ambitious for a research project, she says. Around the same time, Patrick O'Shea was finishing a stint as a middle school teacher in Henderson. He had taken the position through Teach for America, the organization that matches young teachers with underserved schools. He applied to medical schools but was rejected, being told that he needed more clinical experience. He earned a certified nursing assistant license and looked for work to build experience, even shadowing providers when possible. Now, he's a dual MD-MBA student from the UNC School of Medicine and Fuqua, where he connected with Steptoe. Together, they formed MedServe. Students with an undergraduate degree apply to MedServe and are matched with a rural health provider. The fellowship lasts 2 years, at which point fellows leave the program, possibly to attend medical school. Fellows are paid $20,000 per year with the clinics where they work, shouldering a portion of the cost. MedServe also raised money from sources that include the government, UNC, and Duke, and foundations to supplement what healthcare centers can afford. Put simply, the goal of MedServe is to improve the health of communities across North Carolina while exposing potential future doctors to the impact that a primary care physician can make in a community. And along with this article, there's a information on recent trends in health insurance costs that are at historic lows. There are two ways to look at the healthcare cost projections released by PricewaterhouseCoopers Health Research Institute, June 21. HRI projects a 6.5% growth rate for next year. On the one hand, that's higher than general economic inflation, but on the other, it's below the double-digit increases that had become common in the past decade. Forces that typically drive healthcare costs higher are being tempered by demand for value in the new health economy, said Kelly Barnes, U.S. Health Industries and Global Health Industries consulting leader with PwC. Consumers are pushing back against high cost sharing, forcing employers to look for new and creative ways to control spending. In its report, PwC anticipates 2017 will be a year of equilibrium for healthcare spending, and that the year will be a tough balancing act for the health industry. And in a section called Quotable, the quote, the ROSC West Cary application is an ill-timed, ill-devised proposal that, if approved, would contribute little, if anything, to the provision of surgical services in Wake County. WakeMed Health and Hospitals, in a filing opposing a proposed surgery center in Cary that would be jointly operated by Raleigh Orthopedic and UNC Rex Healthcare. Under a section called Greenlighted, mental health entity gets approval to add beds. Triangle Springs Mental Health Hospital has received regulatory approval to add 22 adult chemical dependency treatment beds. Already, the facility plan for Briar Creek was approved for 12 chemical dependency treatment beds and 43 adult psychiatric inpatient beds. The recent approval from North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services will bring the facility's total to 77 beds. Of the 582 existing adult chemical dependency treatment beds in North Carolina, excluding beds in state hospitals, only 32, or 5.5%, are located in Triangle Springs geographic area, according to DHHS data. Holly Hill Hospital in Raleigh has 28 licensed beds, and Cape Fear Valley Medical Center in Cumberland County has 4. Triangle Springs is owned by Springstone, a national chain of private hospitals that treats mental illness. The initial project included just 43 adult psychiatric inpatient beds and had a $15.8 million budget. The additional chemical dependency beds will add about $1.4 million to the overall cost. The facility is scheduled to open in late 2017. And finally, under a section called Big Numbers, $2,300, estimated amount of waste per patient per year on average from drugs left behind in syringes. It is a difference of fractions of a millimeter, but when some of these medications cost more than $20,000 a month, it adds up, said Christine Oramasionuwu, lead author of the study and an assistant professor at UNC Chapel Hill's Eshelman School of Pharmacy. And now we turn to the On Tech and Finance page written by Lauren Onisorge. The main headline, First Citizens cleans up books with FDIC. Raleigh-based First Citizens is paying the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation $20 million to terminate loss share agreements assumed when it acquired certain bank assets. The bank announced this week that it's officially terminating 5 of its 9 loss share agreements. The deals at hand were made between 2009 and 2011 in conjunction with the bank's FDIC-assisted acquisitions of assets and liabilities of 3 banks, Temecula Valley Bank, Sun American Bank, and Colorado Capital Bank. Additionally, 2 other deals were made regarding First Citizens Bank and Trust Company, Incorporated's acquisition of Williamsburg Financial Bank and Atlantic Bank and Trust. First Citizens assumed those liabilities when it purchased First Citizens Bank and Trust Company in 2015. And we also have a listing of First Citizens FDIC deals by the numbers. March 2016, North Milwaukee State Bank, which had a total of $67.1 million in assets. The deal included 2 branches. February 2015, Capital City Bank and Trust Company, which had a total of $275 million in assets. The deal included 8 branches. July 2011, Colorado Capital Bank, which had a total of $717.5 million in assets. The deal included 7 branches. January 2011, United Western Bank, which had a total of $2.1 billion in assets. The deal included 8 branches. March 2010, Sun American Bank, which had a total of $536 million in assets. The deal included 12 branches. January 2010, First Regional Bank, which had a total of $2.2 billion in assets. The deal included 8 branches and 2 loan production offices, a merchant services department, and a trust and investment division. September 2009, Venture Bank, which had a total of $970 million in assets. The deal included 18 branches. And July 2009, Temecula Valley Bank, which had a total of $1.5 billion in assets. The deal included 11 branches. Carrie Jeweler files suit over Instagram incident. A Carrie jewelry store has filed a lawsuit to protect itself over an Instagram image kerfluffle. Artisan Jewelers, which operates out of Cary Town Center, says that when it displayed 6 rings in its Instagram feed in February 2016, it wasn't violating any copyrights as it never actually sold the pictured jewelry. But that didn't stop another jeweler, New York-based Viragio, from threatening legal action. Viragio sent a cease and desist letter to Artisan in March, alleging that the jeweler was, without Viragio's permission, selling rings that were similar to Viragio's copyrighted ring designs. Artisan says in the suit that it removed the Instagram posts, never sold the pictured jewelry, and stopped offering the rings for sale. But it denies that the posts constituted copyright infringement, writing, the mere showing of the rings did not infringe on Verragio's copyrights. A mere offer to sell by showing an image of a ring on Instagram doesn't constitute publication or distribution, the suit reads. But Verragio apparently disagrees. According to the suit, Artisan feels Verragio has threatened litigation, so Artisan is preemptively asking the court to declare that it hasn't infringed on any copyrights, as well as provide necessary further relief, including attorney's fees. Sarah Nagay, an attorney at Raleigh-based Triangle Trademarks, with no direct link to either company, says it's a unique case in her experience. She says that facts would have to be fleshed out regarding the intent of the Instagram posts. They published under their business account, she says. The only reason you'd think a business would publish something on Instagram under the account would be because they're selling it. But if they just posted these pictures but weren't actually selling them, then that's a different issue. She says she's seen preemptive lawsuits like this before, and that it's why she recommends being careful about wording a cease and desist letter. Basically, you get into court first in the area you're in to try to stop a case, she says. IBM opens doors for future techies through program. What looks like a group of high school students is, in fact, a grouping of future technologists. At least that's the hope of the teachers and businesses partnering in what's known as Startup High, an initiative that gets kids off the streets and into technology companies for real-world experiences with what could be their future careers. Last week, gathered in a glass-walled conference center in the middle of what IBM calls its agile workspace, while some of their peers are likely lounging by a pool, it is summer vacation after all, these kids are staring at a screen, learning about what IBM calls serious games. How many of you play video games? Starts Phaedra Boinadris, IBM's Research Triangle Park-based global lead for games, while a bright screenshot from SimCity is showcased on the screen. As a few hands raise, she tells them that instead of just playing, they could be creating. Games, she explains, can be used for training. When plugged into an artificial intelligence platform, such as IBM's own Jeopardy champion Watson, they can help officials test their responses to certain scenarios. They can evaluate someone's toxicity. They can tell if you're a jerk, she says. And they can help government agencies skills building balance teams in the process. Startup High has partnered with Durham Public Schools and the City, American Underground, Frontier, First Flight Venture Center, and First Flight Venture Center. Additional programs are happening with Wake County Schools and Alamance Burlington Schools. And finally, in a section called He Said It, at the end of the day, it's not about the drone. It's about what the drone and the tools can do for the customers. And that's from Bob Young, CEO of Precision Hawk, speaking as the FAA released rules for commercial drone use on June 21. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the small business section, where first we have an article with the headline, How I Found Success by Building Walls. Rubio prepares next tactic to stay ahead of competition, licensing technology. And this article is written by Amanda Hoyle. For much of Edward Rubio's career, he has built walls. The walls of dozens of schools, office buildings, and retail centers all across the Triangle and other parts of North Carolina. Most were built using a combination of the same tried-and-true technology and materials that construction contractors have been using for decades, wood or metal framing, drywall, brick, and concrete. But over the years, Rubio says he got an idea in his head that he just couldn't let go. Too often, he says, the traditional materials used in construction across much of North Carolina and U.S. fail. Mold will infiltrate the drywall. A fire can quickly ravage through wood framing. Most wall structures are no match against a strong tornado or hurricane. So he invented a better wall system made of lightweight precast composite and polymeric foam materials that has a 3-hour fire rating, won't mold, and gives off no emissions. He secured a patent in 2010 for the product, US 7681368B1. He tested it at the Constructed Facilities Laboratory at NC State University and is now putting it through more large-scale testing at a laboratory in South Florida. Rubio's company, American Craftsman Incorporated, which he and his wife founded in 1995, has already built and installed his proprietary panel systems in several building projects around the Triangle and Triad. The first was the renovation and addition at the Hilton Garden Inn in Durham. The hotel's ownership commissioned Rubio's prefabricated panels for use on the hotel's roof, along the pool walls, around the mechanical room and trash containment area, and to support its seven-story fire-rated shaft system. In Cameron Village, Rubio's composite panels are being used for the floor, roof, and walls of a new home that Raleigh restaurateur David Mao is building on Chamberlain Street. Brian Moscow, president of Red Engineering and Design of Apex, and a structural engineer on the Mao home project, says the owner was particularly concerned about future damage to the home by termites or mold. "None of this panel system is organic, so there's no chance of mold. It was a good option to use. It's fairly lightweight and still a strong material." Moscow also noted that the panel system, which for now is being prefabricated at American Craftsman's plant in South Raleigh and installed using a crane, was erected pretty quickly. "For a typical home, the framing could take a couple of months, and this was done in a few weeks," he says. Rubio acknowledges that the cost of his ACI smart wall system costs more than a traditional wood or metal framing job. He won't yet disclose his specific pricing model, but he also notes that the system can generate lower labor costs for its installation and from future maintenance costs. "This is game-changing technology," he says. "We've been stuck in old technology for too long. I wanted to build a better system that's resistant to disaster and still conserves energy. That's why I'm passionate about this. We need to be protecting people better." For the business, Rubio says the next step is to license the technology so other specialty contracting firms like his can manufacture and install the panels in other parts of the country and in other parts of the world. "The technology is too big for us to just hold on to it," he says. And also in the small business section, there's a column written by Dana Mangiagli, who is a contributing writer to the Atlanta Business Chronicle. The headline: Working Remotely, How to Be the Best Virtual Teammate. While virtual teaming presents unique challenges to high performance, trends indicate it is not going away anytime soon. By making sure you're the best virtual teammate you can be, you are positioning yourself to be sought after in any organization. In this globalized, highly connected world, as many as 50 million Americans, 40% of the workforce, work from home at least part of the time. Approximately 48% of all managers spend half of their week working remotely, from home or on the road. Studies reveal that those who work remotely are often more productive than their office-bound counterparts. When it comes to teams, though, the data tell a different story. In their 2001 study of 70 virtual teams, Vijay Govindarajan and Anil Gupta found that 82% of virtual teams fell short of their goals and 33% rated themselves as largely unsuccessful. Furthermore, a 2005 Deloitte study of IT projects outsourced to virtual work groups found that 66% failed to satisfy client requirements. So how do you balance the reality of increased virtual work with the drawbacks of teaming virtually? I spoke with Committed Teams authors Mario Musa, Madeline Boyer, and Derek Newberry about how you can be the best virtual teammate, a skill that will undoubtedly serve you well. Build trust early. Trust is a key to success for any team, but for virtual teams, trust is the glue that binds teammates together across distances and time zones. If people do not trust one another to deliver, they waste time on duplicate efforts, timelines are delayed, and creativity and innovation suffer. Boyer says that, as a virtual teammate, you should capitalize early on swift trust, that benefit of the doubt we give people we've recently met, and turn it into cognitive and effective trust. Cognitive trust is the kind of trust that comes from knowing you'll deliver because you've developed a track record. Effective trust is the feeling that someone can trust you because they know you. Work equally hard early on to produce results and build relationships so that your teammates trust and value your presence on the team. Be explicit about expectations. One of the biggest barriers to virtual teamwork is communication. Newberry says the solution is actually quite simple. Be upfront and clear. Let your teammates know what to expect from you, how often you are available to have conference calls or video chats, whether you prefer emails, texts, or voicemails, and what turnaround time they can expect from you on any given mode. As explicit as, if you send me a text, I'll get back to you within the hour, but I may take up to a day to respond to emails, so if it's important, send me a quick text first, is what Newberry suggests. Check in frequently. When you work on a team that is co-located, it's easy to walk down the hall and pop into Sally's office to ask how she's coming along with that report. Virtual teams don't have the benefit and psychological reassurance of frequent FaceTime. Mousa warns, managers tend to evaluate those working remotely less favorably than those in the office simply because they see them less, even if their performance metrics are even. When working on a virtual team, anxiety levels can rise when team members are not frequently checking in. Check in way more frequently than you normally would on a traditional team. Daily updates on where you stand on key deliverables may seem superfluous, but can go a long way toward positioning you as a star member of whatever team you're on. While virtual teaming presents unique challenges to high performance, trends indicate it is not going away anytime soon. By making sure you are the best virtual teammate you can be, you are positioning yourself to be sought after in any organization. Instacart GM, we're helping local retailers expand sales. And that's the headline on the next article, written by Amanda Hoyle. With the launch of Instacart's mobile grocery shopping platform in the Triangle, expect more traditional and non-traditional retailers to begin adding more direct delivery options for customers. Whole Foods Market was one of Instacart's early adopters and has had a partnership with the San Francisco-based personal shopper and delivery service since 2014. Now even Food Lion, the North Carolina-based grocery chain known for its low budget prices, is buying into the trend. Food Lion began offering home delivery services in the Charlotte market via Instacart in May. The Triangle launch on June 21 is its second big test market. Nick Frederick, Instacart's general manager in charge of the Southeast markets plus New York, says the service launch in Raleigh and Durham has started out strong. It had been a busy day. We're seeing a huge spike in signups, he says. Friedrich would not disclose how many contract shoppers and drivers that the company has hired so far in either Charlotte or the Triangle, except to say that it's in the dozens. By comparison, the company has hundreds of shoppers and drivers in the Atlanta market, but notes also that the Atlanta market has been active for 2 years already. As the Triangle market matures, the company will bring on part-time employees coupled with contractors. We like to start out tight and efficient and grow from there, he says. Drivers are compensated on a per-delivery basis as well as a commission per item shopped. The first order for all new customers in the Triangle includes free delivery. After that, there's a $5.99 fee for an order with a delivery window of 2 hours or more. The fee for an order delivered in an hour or less is $7.99. There's also a $35 minimum order requirement for either category. But also note that Instacart's published prices for store items online can often be higher than the actual price in the store. Friedrich says they try to piggyback off of special sales and offers that its partners offer in store, but not all discounts can be applied. The Triangle market was chosen as Instacart's 23rd market, he says, primarily due to requests from its retail partners, requests from potential customers who have already tried to log into its retail app, and from a study of the region's shopping audience. There's a strong tech community here and a very broad audience that we found in other markets are already using our services. It seemed like a great fit. Another benefit that Instacart brings for customers is access to the club member warehouses via Costco and BJ's per a partnership between Instacart and both companies. Online shoppers do not have to have a club membership to order via Instacart. In the Triangle, Friedrich says the next step for the company will be to expand the number of retail partners in the area, including regional and local retailers that might want to add Instacart's third-party services. Unlike Amazon's Prime Now services, which stores and delivers products from its own local inventory, Instacart buys on-demand products from local retail partners. We enable the customer to shop from local places they already shop at, and we help local retailers expand their sales. We're excited to be a part of that. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal. And first we have the Editor's Notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, who is editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Numbers Don't Lie, Metros Fuel Most Growth. On June 24, hundreds of mayors from across the country were handed a report called the Metro Economics Report at Indianapolis. The report ranked the economic performance and job growth forecasts for the country's 363 metropolitan areas. The Raleigh area was ranked 44th on the list, with a $79.7 billion gross metropolitan product, GMP, output in 2016, an increase of about 12% from 2014. In contrast, the Charlotte area was ranked 22nd, with a 2016 GMP of $157.9 billion, almost double that of Raleigh. But the numbers become interesting when the report forecasts based on demographics, historical growth, and economic diversity. Raleigh ranks 8th when it comes to real average annual growth, a metric based on most recent performance, 2015, to the potential upside, 2021. Not far behind, the Durham-Chapel Hill market ranks 15th. Again, in contrast, Charlotte ranks 35th. These may just be numbers to some, but it really is a looking glass by which we can prepare our business plan, development blueprint, and hiring projections. There is little doubt that Charlotte remains substantially bigger to Raleigh and Durham combined when it comes to share of the GMP as a percentage of North Carolina's $505 billion gross domestic product, the benchmark that values the economic activity in the state. Charlotte accounts for 27.5% of that activity. Raleigh comes in next with 15%, and Durham area accounts for about 9%. But it also is true that the Raleigh area has come out of the Great Recession faster than anyone in the state. After losing some 31,000-plus jobs in the Raleigh MSA between Q1 2008 and the end of the recession in 2011, the mayor's report concludes that Raleigh hit its pre-recession growth mark during third quarter 2012, one of the fastest turnarounds among all metros. For Durham, authors say the city will not get back to pre-recession employment growth until 2021. And for Charlotte, where the loss of jobs was 10 times greater than of Raleigh during the four-year recession, the turnaround was substantially slower, second quarter of 2015, but is underway nonetheless. Reading through this dense economic report, there is little doubt that if you want to have a prosperous state with a sound fiscal agenda, focus on the state's largest metros. Here are two bullet points that reiterate my point. Metropolitan areas drove the U.S. economy in 2015. They were home to 85.7% of the nation's population, 87.7% of total employment, 87.9% of total real income, 91.3% of wage income, and 90.8% of GDP. And metros contributed 96.5% of all the new jobs since 2000. And also on the Viewpoint page, we have another Viewpoint written by Danny McComas, who is a former Republican state representative from Wilmington, and David Young, who is a former Buncombe County commissioner, a former president of the North Carolina Association of Counties, and former state chair of the North Carolina Democratic Party. Their Viewpoint article has the headline of, Here is our bipartisan solution to broadband regulations. North Carolina's Attorney General is currently battling it out with the Federal Communications Commission, FCC, in federal court over a Tar Heel state law that ensures a level playing field between private broadband networks and government-owned ones. At issue is a ruling from last February in which the FCC voted narrowly and along party lines to overturn our broadband law. The three commissioners who favored the order argued it would help expand broadband access. We disagree, and as former elected officials, one Republican and one Democrat, we believe there's a better, more bipartisan solution when it comes to broadband. First, because government-owned broadband networks have the implicit backing of the taxpayer, and because they are exempt from some of the fees and regulations that private sector internet service providers, ISPs, have to pay and abide by, we believe government networks actually crowd out private investment. Private ISPs simply can't compete when the playing field is so badly tilted against them. Right now, according to CNBC's annual rankings of the best states to do business, North Carolina is in the top 10. We're among the top states for technology and innovation, and we provide excellent access to capital, all factors that make the Tar Heel State a great place to invest. However, if we allow the FCC to overturn our state municipal broadband law, our excellent business ranking is at risk because it will signal to private job creators that our government is more focused on competing against them than it is on creating a hospitable environment for investment and innovation. Unlike the FCC chairman and other government broadband supporters, we do not believe broadband should be treated like a utility or like more traditional types of infrastructure. Building broadband networks is not akin to building roads and bridges or operating wastewater systems. While roads and bridges may need to be resurfaced or reinforced regularly, they don't go out of date quickly. Broadband infrastructure does, and government agencies, even utilities, simply don't have the expertise or funding to keep up with the improvements needed to keep a broadband system on the cutting edge. Finally, state and local lawmakers have other pressing priorities they must focus on, and building broadband networks will hamper their ability to do so. Our state ranks near the bottom in per capita public health spending and average teacher salaries. Our existing traditional infrastructure also ranks poorly, receiving mediocre grades at best and near failing at worst. Further, it's also not great to be a taxpayer in our state. With the cost of living factored in, we're in the top 20 in terms of overall tax burden. Private sector companies can serve our broadband needs. They can't pay our teachers or lower our tax burden. So we should leave internet service to them. But too many cities aren't. In Salisbury, $1 of every $12 in tax revenue goes to support the city-owned broadband system. That's $3 million in revenue that won't reach the city's public school students, police, or fire departments. There's little doubt that access to broadband is a necessary tool in today's economy. Our small businesses need to be able to engage in e-commerce to compete with larger companies in other states and countries. Our students need to have adequate access to the state-of-the-art learning tools they can find online, and our public safety and emergency response teams need to be able to communicate quickly and clearly in the field. To improve broadband access, however, we must partner with the private sector, not compete against it. Our state lawmakers should identify ways to break down barriers to private investment, and they should make it clear that North Carolina will preserve the level playing field we currently provide for private ISP. We must continue to fight the FCC, look for new and innovative ways to open our state to additional private sector broadband investment, and preserve our precious tax dollars for the vital programs like education, public health, and infrastructure that need it the most. That's the smart solution, and it's the bipartisan one. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the People on the Move page, where the spotlight is on Jason Doty, North Carolina office leader at Modjeski and Masters. Fresh out of college, Jason Doty began his career as an entry-level engineer at Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania-based Modjeski and Masters. He remained at the firm for a decade until jumping ship for a consulting firm in North Carolina. Now he's back at the firm he started with, but this time he's tasked with building its presence in the Tar Heel State. As the leader of Modjeski and Masters' New Raleigh office, its only location in North Carolina, Doty is responsible for identifying and securing work in the state and the surrounding region. He's also charged with mentoring and developing the firm's local staff of bridge engineering professionals and with overseeing the engineering work performed in its Raleigh office. Modjeski and Masters is one of the world's largest bridge engineering firms. It is an employee-owned company that employs 185 people, firm-wide, spread across 11 offices. The Wrightsville Beach Bridge Deck Replacement and the Cape Fear Bascule Bridge Rehabilitation are two of the firm's recently completed projects in North Carolina. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? The sense of satisfaction that comes with a project well done. Hopefully my grandkids can drive across or view some of the bridges Majeski and Masters design. Knowing that we've made a positive impact on the American infrastructure is a great reward. What are some of your major goals for your new position? Leading the Raleigh office, I am focused on developing a diverse and sound work backlog, nurturing and developing my local staff of bridge engineering professionals, and strengthening our already strong relationship with the NCDOT. Biggest pet peeve? The attitude that you can just ignore infrastructure issues and they will somehow fix themselves. Biggest worry? It's a good problem to have, but I worry that we may outgrow our current office space sooner than expected. With an on-call contract with NCDOT and the rapidly growing local and state populations, there will be plenty of work to do. Family. Doty is married and has three sons, Nolan, Morgan, and Mason. Last book you've read, Sycamore Row by John Grisham. And with our remaining minutes with the Triangle Business Journal, we'll return to the 40 Under 40 articles. Let's see, the next one we'll read is on Sharon Bew of Frill Clothing. Title, CEO, age 25. Company description, maker of skirts, tops, and dresses for sorority recruitment. Birthplace, Raleigh. Family members, mother, Lan Tran. Father, Hi Bew. Brother, Kevin. Sister-in-law, Heather. Nephew Harrison, grandfather John Richards, grandmother Joanne Richards. What accomplishments are you most proud of? This award. I am also proud that we made it on Shark Tank and scored a deal with Kevin O'Leary and Barbara Corcoran. I am also proud that I am a traveling speaker now. I used to get so nervous presenting in college. What is your professional goal 5 years from now? I would like to be just like Sheryl Sandberg, COO of Facebook. She is an American technology executive, activist, and author. I love tech, helping the community, and inspiring others. I aspire to be just like her and rise to the top to prove that women can hold executive positions and succeed. What is the greatest obstacle you have overcome in your career? Starting a business at age 20 and working with the generation above me has been difficult. In my industry, it was hard to be taken seriously because I was so young. It was hard to gain respect over the years. After we were on national TV a few times, we started to gain respect from our peers in the industry. It was not easy getting to that point, and we got a lot of no's, but we never gave up. Finish the sentence. What the Triangle really needs is... Top Golf. I hate playing golf, watching golf, etc., but I recently got back from a speaking trip in Dallas and played Top Golf and fell in love. Also, better development pathways for the youth to enter the working industry straight from and during college. Nothing makes me madder than when people discriminate against me because of my age or race. Who is your mentor? Anthony Pompliano and Justin Miller from Wedpix, local successful startup. What is your favorite Triangle restaurant? Cowfish, Neomond, or Shuck and Shack? I could eat it every day. Who would make the guest list for your dream business lunch? Sheryl Sandberg, Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, Anna Wintour, Taylor Swift, Beyonce, James Goodnight, Chuck Robbins, and Ellen DeGeneres. I would also love to have my favorite bloggers, McKenna Blue, Caitlin Coving, and Emily Ann Gemma. What is your secret talent? Being an Oprah to people. I swear I could produce great reality shows. People will come to my office for a 5-minute meeting and will end up telling me their life stories and pouring their hearts out. And next is Tashni Ann DeBroy of Shaw University. Title, President. Age, 35. Company description, university. Birthplace, Manchester, Jamaica. Family members, husband Dale, daughter Marley Jolie. Dog, Buster, Baymax Hero DuBois. Education, BS, Shaw University. Doctorate, NC State University. MBA, Rutgers. What accomplishment are you most proud of? While I am definitely proud of my accomplishments as an entrepreneur and college president, all before age 35, it is my daughter's, Marley Jolie, sense of confidence and sweet nature that I am most proud of. What is your professional goal 5 years from now? After presiding at Shaw University, I would like to play in the ed tech space while working for my iPhone on the beach in the Caribbean. What community cause or charity have you been involved in during the past year? The Brilliant and Beautiful Foundation, the Girl Scouts, playing the role of a STEM advocate where I encourage young women to pursue the sciences. What is the greatest obstacle you have overcome in your career? I stepped out of a comfortable job in corporate to pursue entrepreneurship. As if that wasn't bold enough, I later applied for the presidency at my alma mater and nailed the job. I'm the youngest female to hold the position. Finish the sentence. What the Triangle really needs is a water feature in downtown Raleigh. Nothing makes me madder than negative people who complain often but seldom have a solution to remedy the problem. Who is your mentor? Oprah, but she doesn't know it. What is your favorite Triangle restaurant? ORO and Bahama Breeze. Who would make the guest list for your dream business lunch? Melinda Gates, Michelle Obama, Warren Buffett, Oprah Winfrey, Jim Goodnight, Beyonce, and the Dalai Lama. What is your secret talent? I can sing. And actually, we're going to stop there with the Triangle Business Journal as we've run out of time for today's episode. But be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.